Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the home stretch to Copenhagen, anti-climate change computer hackers stole files, emails, from climate scientists that revealed some rough tactics in the research world. The scientists say it's a tempest in a teapot, that the science of global warming is sound and very ominous. Warming skeptics are crying scandal. Meanwhile, American public opinion has been weakening on global warming concern just as the world attempts to move toward action. This hour, On Point, stolen emails, public opinion, and global warming as the big climate change summit opens in Copenhagen. You can join the conversation. Do you see sabotage, scandal, something else in the stolen emails? And will ClimateGate derail Copenhagen? Will we miss the window to act? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Here's the Danish National Girls Choir at the opening ceremony in Copenhagen. Please help save the world. You heard the little girl saying earlier, the world did, in the opening ceremonies in Copenhagen, the big UN summit there. Joining me now from Washington is Juliet Eilprin. She's environmental reporter for The Washington Post and has been covering the stolen email story as well as policy and public opinion leading up to Copenhagen. She's flying to Denmark just about as soon as we're finished here. Juliet, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Nice to be here.
First, agenda in Copenhagen. There's not going to be a signed, sealed agreement out of this, we're told. What are people hoping for?
People who are backing this are hoping for a robust political agreement where you will essentially have the architecture and the contents of a future international binding treaty that would be done next year. And so what we're talking about is commitments from the major industrialized countries to curb their carbon emissions in both the near term and the long term. A less ambitious but similar related commitment by major emerging economies like China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Mexico, and a commitment of money from the richer countries of the world to transfer that to poorer nations so they can both combat their own greenhouse gas emissions by adopting cleaner technology and have money to cope with the real-time effects we're seeing of climate change, whether that's rising sea level, extended drought, or the melt of glaciers.
So without a signed, sealed agreement in Copenhagen, will there be, nevertheless, real negotiation going on there, Juliet?
Absolutely. There's serious negotiation. This first week, what's kicked off today, is kind of technical negotiation. The high-level talks are actually next week. But what you are talking about is a bunch of give and take by all the parties. We have 192 countries that take part in these negotiations. And one of the interesting things about it being sponsored by the United Nations is that everybody has a vote that's equal. So you really need a consensus to come out of this process. It's not just the big influential countries that lay down what happens.
A consensus being hammered out, maybe, climate change activists hope, and the whole world watching that. There's been so much anticipation of this. Here's a promotional video put out by the International Advertising Association in partnership with the UN and corporate sponsors called Hopenhagen.
I'm a citizen of Copenhagen.
Let's turn Copenhagen into Copenhagen.
The ocean gives me hope.
Animals give
Global
me hope.
Freedom.
Renewable resources give me hope.
Water conservation gives me hope.
Recycling gives me hope.
Copenhagen gives me hope.
Juliet Eilprin with The Washington Post. You'll be there soon enough, but what about the public opinion envelope around this big meeting? Of course, attitudes are different in different countries. They're very extremely widely around the world, but we'll hear from some pollsters, but you've done your own polling there at the Washington Post, that finding that Americans are less supportive or less worried about global warming than they have been in the past.
Yes, we've seen an interesting kind of political divide reemerge on this issue. And so while the overall findings of our recent poll was that 72% of Americans still believe that climate change is real, and 52%, a thin majority, 52 to 43%, think that, Congress should act on this. What you're finding is that increasingly Republicans, as well as to a lesser extent independents, are less interested and feel that this is less of an important issue and less of a real issue than they did from 3.5 years ago, which was kind of the all-time high of Americans' concern about climate change. So you've seen a dip, particularly among Republicans, a drop-off of 22% over the last 3 years in terms of thinking that climate change is real.
There's also been, of course, the great flurry of headlines about the so-called Climate Gate, the emails stolen from the Climate Research Center indicating some very rough and tumble action in the research world around this. Do you see that impacting the polls, or have all the polls that have been done, were they done before this the emails were stolen and published, Julia?
The polls were done before the emails were disclosed, and so it's too early to tell kind of what impact that's had on public opinion. It hasn't affected policy. The disclosure has not affected policymakers, but it very well could affect Americans' views on this. But so that we have to say, but it certainly sparked a flurry of debate, primarily on the internet, where as well as in news outlets, where really people are saying, what does it mean that these scientists were having kind of heated back and forth about specific parts of the science, as well as what they thought of their opponents on the issue, and it kind of remains to be seen if that's going to make Americans less willing to engage in this issue.
Now, certainly, critics of the climate change hypothesis, and more than that at this point, have been very tough on this. Here's Rush Limbaugh ripping into scientists that were involved here last week, mocking UN climate officials who tried to push aside the controversial emails as not relevant.
Getting rid of the data? No, that doesn't harm what we're doing here. Fudging the data so that cooling trends don't show up. Remember, in these emails, somebody wrote to somebody, it's devastating. It is devastating that we can't explain the Earth cooling. Meaning, they don't have a reason that they could give for the Earth cooling that would also support the whole global warming thesis. It's devastating, so they hide it.
So they hide it, says Rush Limbaugh. Juliet, what's known at this point about who broke in, stole the emails, and put them out before the world?
Frankly, that's something that's still unknown, and there are investigators in Britain primarily who are looking into this. So they have not identified who's broken in. There are early indications that they actually broke in to the research unit's server in October and deliberately waited to disclose these emails until a couple of weeks ago.
This is at East Anglia University in the UK.
Exactly, the climatic research unit at University of East Anglia. And the director, who was one of the primary writers of these emails, has temporarily stepped aside as the university investigate what's happening. But that said, so that is something that I think will be very interesting to see, you know, kind of who's the group who did this. It's clearly a group or some individuals who are skeptical of what's happening on climate change.
13 years of emails here. I'm sure you've looked at many of them at this point. Do you see a smoking gun that undercuts what we've been told about the urgency of the human carbon contribution to global warming or not?
No, I don't. And actually, it's important to note, you know, in that clip of Glenn Beck, that's very interesting how he described
Limbaugh. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Rush Limbaugh. He described those in a way that's not accurate. When he was referring, there was, for example, a researcher, a respected researcher, Kevin Trenberth from the National Atmospheric Research Center for Atmospheric Research.
Mm-hmm.
He, for example, said that it's a, quote, travesty that we're not seeing more warming in the system given the greenhouse gases that will be emitted. But that's different from saying it's a travesty that we can't show warming when there is, in fact, cooling. So I think part of what you have is that, these emails can be interpreted a number of ways depending on your perspective. And so I think that that's part of what's happening here. And, in fact, there's nothing in this that shows that, for example, you know, climate change is not caused by human activity, but certainly it does raise some questions about the tactics of researchers as they engaged in a very public debate over more than a decade over what was happening with climate change.
So when this researcher said it's a travesty, how do you interpret that? What does that mean? bewailing that they couldn't find that they didn't have the science to show it or what?
What it means is, and this does show you that there are still limits to, you know, how we understand what's happening in terms of climate change. What he was saying is that you cannot perfectly track how energy moves through how energy moves through the world climate system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as simple as we put out X amount of greenhouse gases and you get X amount of warming or X amount of sea level rise. So what he's trying to say is that we need to really improve our observing system. We need to develop more sophisticated models in order to have a better understanding of what's going to happen and exactly how this operates. But so you know, I think that it's a very interesting issue, and it's actually, he's published a scientific paper about this. So this wasn't something that he hid from the public, but it does show you that even some of the top researchers, you know, can't give us all the answers about what's happening at this exact moment.
And there has been very tough campaigning in opposition to climate change research. I mean, these guys, I suppose at times they must have felt in the bunker. There's very fierce opposition to them, some political, some scientific.
Yes, I mean, we've absolutely, you know, they've been the target of online campaigns and PR campaigns, including, you know, Michael Mann, who I know will be speaking with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really do, I think, over time see that, you know, that time and time again, they're dealing with personal attacks that are aimed at them and aimed at their research. And, you know, you obviously are seeing in this kind of opportunity where we're seeing kind of their private thoughts and conversations that they felt defensive and, in fact, at times lashed out at their critics.
Do you think that the revelation of these emails and the extracts, you know, that have that have been put out in public are going to have already affected what comes out of Copenhagen or not?
I do not. I don't see actually any indication of that. It doesn't seem to be affecting both what the Obama administration is doing there or what other countries are doing. So as much as that there is a lot of dissent that's cropping up in Britain where this first broke and as well as in the United States, I don't see it having a significant impact on the outcome of the talks, just given the politics of the governments that are negotiating this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about global warming, public opinion, stolen emails, as the big global climate change summit opens today in Copenhagen. Here was a little Danish jazz trumpet music in the opening ceremony today. I don't know if that's a battle cry or a dirge, but that was part of the opening ceremony in Copenhagen. Juliet Alperin joins us from Washington with the Washington Post. She's headed today to Copenhagen to cover everything going on there. We'll hear in just a moment from one of the scientists involved in the revealed, stolen and revealed emails and a lot of big climate research. But first, here's Jonathan Pershing, chief negotiator of the United States delegation at the UN climate negotiations, on what might be accomplished in Copenhagen.
I'm fairly optimistic that we'll succeed. Always you have this period of caution before things emerge into the light, and I think we're in the period of caution right now, but optimistic caution.
Optimistic caution, but if you listen to critics and those presenting a sort of different attitude off of these emails that have come out, you know, here's on Fox News last Monday, senior political analyst Britt Hume saying more Americans are now doubting global warming.
Global warming, climate change has been dropping lower and lower in people's list of priorities for a long time now. And doubts about whether man is causing it and about the whole theory of it have been rising. So this can only further that and only add to the sense that this is not a politically urgent matter and that perhaps it may all even be a fraud.
Drumbeat of doubt there. The scientists continue to say it is absolutely urgent. Juliet Alperin, and news coming today from the Environmental Protection Agency. By the time President Obama gets to Copenhagen next week on the 18th, the last day, it appears he will have a new arrow in his quiver, given what's coming out today from the EPA, Juliet.
Exactly. The EPA today is announcing that it is making the final scientific finding that greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, endanger public health and welfare. This lays the groundwork for regulation of greenhouse gases, whether or not Congress passes a climate bill, which it may do early in this, you know, next year. And so this is a really significant announcement, both because of what it does in terms of a regulatory framework, that it basically will allow the administration and EPA to move on this, but also because it sends a signal both to the international community as well as domestically that, like it or not, the Obama administration is going to put mandatory limits on greenhouse gases here in the United States.
And so a lot of leverage with that, a lot of pushback from the business community, but that's coming, and it may add some urgency to what's going on in Copenhagen, showing seriousness in the United States. We're joined right now by one of the scientists in the whole world of controversy around the emails that came out last month. Michael Mann joins us from University Park, Pennsylvania. He's director of the Earth System Science Center there and a professor in the Department of Meteorology at Pennsylvania State. Michael Mann, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be with you.
How are you processing the sort of public exposure of all the email back and forth that you're very much part of that's come out in what climate change what opponents are now calling ClimateGate?
Right. Well, we have to sort of look at the context in which this is occurring. We've reached a point in the scientific community. Scientists around the world have come to a consensus that climate change, human-caused climate change, is indeed a reality, and it's something that we need to contend with. And so now, as we go into this historic summit in Copenhagen, where there's a possibility of action being taken, there are those individuals and special interests who don't want to see any progress made. They don't have the science on their side. And so what they've done is to engage in an 11th-hour smear campaign to try to distract the public, to try to distract policymakers, and take their eye off the ball at this historic time.
If climate change is for real, and scientists say it is, that would be tragic. On the other hand, some of the language in here is pretty tough for people outside the scientific community to understand as neutral or solid. I mean, what's been most damaging in the revelations to your mind? And explain it to us.
Yeah, well, as Juliet has already nicely pointed out, what we have here is a situation where thousands of emails have been mined for individual words or phrases, little snippets that are part of the informal discussions between scientists who speak in their own lingo, and they have been completely taken out of context and twisted to distort what the scientists are actually talking about and what we're saying to each other in these emails. And I think that's very unfortunate. One of the examples was the selective and misleading quotation of words by my respected colleague Kevin Trenberth, who is by no stretch of the imagination a climate change denier. As Juliet explained, he was simply talking about some of the limitations in our current observing system and the importance of improving that observing system so we can figure out exactly how the climate is behaving as it's warming up in response to human behavior.
So you know that, I mean, you've got, for example, Congressman Sensenbrenner, James Sensenbrenner in Wisconsin, saying it's time to take back the notion that the science is settled. You've got Senator Inhofe asking for an inquiry into the contents of all these emails. Do you see this constituting a real bump in the road, a real, more than that, obstacle for acting on climate change?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that some are obviously using this as a cheap opportunity to score rhetorical points in the public debate about climate change. As Juliet has already explained, there's absolutely nothing in any of these emails that is indicative of any sort of scientific misbehavior, misconduct that in any way calls into question the overwhelming evidence for the reality of the problem. There's nothing in these emails that does that. What the opponents have done is to try to distort what's in the emails to confuse people and to make them think that there is less agreement among scientists on the basic points than there actually is.
Let's get our listeners in right here. David in Iowa City, Iowa. David, you're on the air. Hello, David. Are you there, my friend?
I'm concerned about the fact that you and other people in the media repeat the baseless claim that humans don't contribute to climate change and aren't doing so in a serious way. Knowledgeable scientists only disagree about how much the change is and whether it's really serious or terribly awfully serious. And when you quote these people who suggest it isn't serious at all and the knowledgeable scientists disagree, you're fueling the deniers. And that's a mistake and is making a bad contribution to the debate. It's almost as if you would have a show where you would raise a question about whether evolution exists and therefore give aid to the irrational large population in the United States who denies evolution.
David, I understand exactly what you're saying. At the same time, you know, here we have a fact in many public opinion polls of American public opinion weakening on the weight given to climate change. And maybe not in media outlets that you pay attention to, but in a lot of them, this is out in a huge way. It seems important to pick it up and deal with it. We're trying to do that right here. But Juliet Alperin, you know, what do you make of what David's saying? You're off to Copenhagen yourself. You, like us, try to deal with the facts as we know them, and yet here's something going on in public. It's hard to ignore, Juliet.
Absolutely. And what I would say is, you know, I think we make an effort to talk about the science. We make it clear on our stories about what the scientific facts are, you know, where we stand on that. But I think it is important to talk about this is a significant constituency, and you can't ignore what they're saying. And one thing I find really interesting is that you have a situation where we had a number of people who I interviewed after the poll was taken where they honestly don't think that climate change is happening at all, or they don't think humans are doing anything, but they will back a legislative cap on carbon, and they're okay with a global agreement where we do more than other countries like China and India. Now, I can't really explain the logic behind those findings, but that's what some Americans are saying, and I think it's important that we convey what people are thinking on this right now.
There's a complex brew of public opinion out there. We're trying to fit it together with the facts as known here. Juliet Alperin, on your way to Copenhagen, have a good flight, and thank you very much for joining us today, Juliet.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Juliet Alperin with the Washington Post there. Michael Mann, how about our caller, David, in Iowa? Do you agree with him? Should we just shut down the mics on this controversy and pay it no mind, or pick it up and examine it? What?
Well, I think there are a number of journalistic outlets who have dealt with this issue responsibly. And as Juliet has alluded to, not just talking about the controversy of the stolen emails, but placing that in a proper context of does this in any way call into question what we know about the reality of climate change. There are various examples where, as I said before, the words of scientists have been twisted to misrepresent what they're actually saying. If you look at these email correspondences, if you read them all and you read through them, what you'll actually see is a very healthy debate. You see scientists, including myself and Kevin Trenberth and others, debating with each other what the evidence shows, what our best explanation is for things that we don't quite understand, that we're still trying to figure out about the way the climate system works. You see anything but the sort of collusion, the conspiracy that our detractors would like you to think exists within the climate research community.
I want to look more deeply at public opinion on this front, if I may. Michael Mann, stand by. Joining us from Washington is Carol Doherty, Associate Editorial Director at the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. Carol Doherty, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning, Tom.
It's good to have you with us. You've been doing a lot of public opinion research. Way back in January, you found that of the top 20, you know, top concerns of Americans, global warming was dead last, number 20. That's long before these emails were put out in the public arena. What about your most recent polls among Americans? They show concern dropping as well, as I understand it, and I wonder what you found and what you make of it.
Well, the headline finding on our poll was that we ask a question about is there solid evidence that global warming is occurring, and it's down to 57%, a majority, but a much lower majority than just a year ago at 71%.
That's a pretty big drop in a single year. To what do you attribute that? Is it just people having their eye taken off of it by economic crisis of the last year or something else, Carol?
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. I mean, certainly, as Juliet noted earlier in the Washington Post poll and our poll, politicized reactions to this issue. Just 35% of Republicans say that global warming, there's solid evidence of global warming versus 75% of Democrats and 53% of independents. But we've seen some shift in the last year across the board. which suggests perhaps the economy is a factor here, in the sense that I think there's a broad recognition that any solutions will be very expensive, and people then back up and say, well, maybe there's a little more doubt that it's actually happening.
Let's get a call from Lansing, Michigan. Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say good luck with American public opinion. It seems like a couple of years ago when the price of gas was about $5 a gallon, everybody was up in arms about global warming. They sat up and took notice, and now that it's been cut in half, everybody doesn't seem to think it's so serious anymore. I don't know if it has anything to do with it, but it almost seems like we need some kind of catastrophe, whether it's in the pocketbook or the ocean washing up on your doorstep, before Americans wake up. I really hope that public opinion changes back and people sit up and really take seriously this is really happening, and something needs to be done now. And it's just nuts, you know, how wishy-washy Americans can be.
And that is that's the gist. That's the hope in Copenhagen. Jeffrey, thank you very much for your call. Carol, what about straight-up energy prices and U.S. public opinion on this? Do you see a correlation between concern rising and falling, depending how much it costs to heat the house, fill up the gas tank?
There might be correlations in a number of areas, possibly even the weather perhaps playing a small role. It's hard to know. I think, again, the major factor is probably political over recent years. I mean, it's important to note that as recently as 2007, 62% of Republicans said there was solid evidence of global warming. That's a little over 2 years ago, and now it's down to 35%. So politics has had an effect as well.
That's amazing. Tony in Louisville, Kentucky. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess my comment is just that I feel, you know, climate change is one of the symptoms of environmental degradation. I feel like what needs to be provided is a scientific lesson where you look at the problem as an algorithm, and it's like A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Take all the factors involved: habitat destruction, air, land, water pollution, and it equals something that has to be dealt with. And the political discussion, you know, should be just looked at as, you know, a sports game, you know, like Team A versus Team B. That's not, I think, yeah, just...
It's not the same as the science. Absolutely. Tony, thank you for that. Michael Mann, part of what seemed to me out of these emails was that it just didn't boil quite down to as simple a formula as Tony offers from Louisville. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. You can read and hear in these emails scientists struggling to put all the data together.
Well, it's important to realize that what scientists are struggling about, debating with each other, actively publishing papers about in the peer-reviewed literature, is at the frontiers of the field. That is to say, there are always going to be things that we don't understand perfectly. That's the way science works. And
yep.
We have to be skeptics. Skepticism in science is not only a good thing, it's an essential thing. We have to subject the data, our theories, to as much scrutiny as possible. And that's what scientists are constantly doing, whether it's in the peer-reviewed literature or even in the private emails that have been released here. Now, there are certain things that we don't debate. And if you look at the peer-reviewed literature, you won't see papers presenting contrary evidence against, like the fact that increasing certain constituents in our atmosphere, increasing concentrations of so-called greenhouse gases, leads to a warming of the atmosphere. We've actually known that for nearly 200 years. In the early 19th century, famous scientists like Fourier were aware of the greenhouse effect. Mostly what we've been doing over the past 200 years is refining that understanding, better estimating so-called feedbacks. Are there factors that can amplify the warming further once it gets started? How do those factors work? And increasingly, we're looking to answer more and more detailed questions. But there is absolutely no debate within the legitimate climate research community about the reality of human-caused climate change.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about global warming, public opinion, and stolen emails as the Climate Change Summit opens in Copenhagen. Here's Ivo de Boer, Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, talking about the trail of stolen, publicized scientific emails that have come out calling skeptics idiots and climate contrarians work as garbage and fraud. Here he is.
Well, it does look bad, of course. I mean, this correspondence looks very bad, but I think that both the university is looking into this. I believe there's a police investigation going on whether the emails were leaked or stolen.
Okay, that's going on, but there is also a lot of impatience all over the world about something being done to address carbon emissions and climate change. Protesters here were in the streets across Europe this weekend calling for strong action at Copenhagen. The biggest was protests were in London. About 20,000 marched to protest global warming.
Climate justice now, and we want a deal at Copenhagen that keeps the world safe.
We want a deal at Copenhagen. Michael Mann is with us from the Penn State University, the Earth System Science Center there, a top climate scientist, and a lot of his emails were among those revealed in the stolen batch. Carol Doherty of the Pew Center for People and the Press is with us as well. He's been looking at public opinion polls in this country and around the world. Let's get a call from Xin Ming in Boston. Xin Ming, you're on the air.
Hi. It seems to me that some of the cover-up behavior, what looks like cover-up behavior, is the clumsiness of scientists who are frustrated in the face of a sophisticated marketing technology. We're talking about billions of dollars over decades fine-tuned in the methods to make the public believe something is true, regardless of whether it's true or not. So techniques like staying on message and dumbing things down, when interpreted by scientists, I think come up result in behaviors like what we've seen.
You're saying they've been up against a marketing campaign to discredit their findings, in effect.
Yes, and so there's a clash here between scientific uncertainty, for example, and right and wrong from public policy perspective. But my question is, so partly, first of all, to what extent is that true? Secondly, how do scientists succeed in a democracy, but at the same time recognize that the history of science is that scientists are not purists either, that there are paradigm shifts, that there is the politics internally, there's anchoring behavior and so forth?
Exactly. Great question. Stick with us, Xin Ming. Michael Mann, what do you say? It's a thoughtful inquiry here about, you know, how science proceeds against these kind of headwinds, against what pretty rough and tumble opposition. You know, throughout history, I mean, we've seen skepticism in response to scientific revelation. And as Xin Ming points out, you know, scientists aren't angels either. They're human.
Well, of course, we're human, and we're all subject to the frailties of being human. But it's very important to understand that what you see in the scientific discourse is passionate discussions, debate, disagreements, bouncing ideas off each other. Ultimately, we're all looking to figure out the truth. That's what drives scientists, figuring out how things work, not any sort of political agenda. Now, often, as the work progresses, as we learn more about the science, we become more and more convinced that there may be a reality, there may be a problem that has implications for greater society. An excellent example of that was work back in the 1970s and 1980s, as we began to discover that there was a hole, an ozone hole, over Antarctica. We were losing stratospheric ozone, which, of course, protects the surface from damaging ultraviolet radiation. Our observations were telling us this was happening. Meanwhile, scientists were working on the theory. We're looking at the underlying chemistry that might be involved, the atmospheric dynamics that might be involved. And ultimately, the two things came together. The observations that ozone was being depleted, the theoretical framework for understanding why, that indeed it was the production by humans of chlorofluorocarbons, these chemicals that under certain circumstances can break down ozone. Mm. We recognized the problem early enough that we were able to inform the policy debate leading to the passage in 1988 of the Montreal Protocol, which banned those ozone-depleting substances, we are still seeing the ozone layer recover. This is decades later, and it still has not recovered to the pristine character that it had before we were damaging it with these chemicals. So that tells you that there are long time scales involved. We can't just wait until the science on something like this becomes certain. That will never happen. The science never becomes certain. But it becomes solid enough to act on, and that's what happened with the ozone hole, which we're still recovering from. That's what is happening with human-caused climate change, and we have an opportunity to contend with that before it becomes too late as well, before the warming becomes so large that it begins to have damaging impacts on society, on civilization, on our environment.
Xingmin, let me come back to you. Do you feel confident that there will be global action in time, as Michael Mann says?
I'm not, and that's I think it's important for scientists to understand that perception is reality, and the fact that we've gone from ozone holes to nuclear winter and global warming gives a science sometimes the semblance of unreliability. And so how to integrate science into the public discourse is not only a matter of educating the public about science, but also something that should be taught to scientists, I think, in their education, how to integrate the science into democratic.
Yeah, you may be right about that. Get some training on how to convey their findings most effectively. I mean, Carol Doherty, Xingmin, thanks for calling. Carol Doherty, I was really struck by Pew's findings about the wide disparity in public attitudes globally to the question of whether global warming is a very serious problem. You've got such a range of responses to that depending on the country you're asking. In Brazil, 90% of those polled said yes. Argentina, 69%. France, 68%. South Korea, 68%. India, 67%. But if you go all the way down to the bottom of the heap, in China, only 30% say global warming is a very serious problem. Poland, 36%. Russia and the United States way down there, 44%. It's a strikingly wide gap in public response on that question, Carol.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the, I guess, troubling perspectives from the people who would like to take action on this is that, you know, among the main countries emitting greenhouse gases, there's less of a belief, like in China and the United States, there's less of a belief that this is a very serious problem.
So, wow. Paul in Albany, New York. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. I have just two issues. The first one being, while I respect the professor's dialect as it pertains to science, I am a rookie, so to speak, and have basically knowledge. But I do find it that in the media, for all the talk of opposing, like, we hear these scientists, that is not that they don't exist, but I think they're being silenced for one reason or another. And the other issue is, I have a real problem with a UN world global consensus making judgment against people, especially in our country, on what we should contribute. Now, I will say that I do believe that man's contribution to global warming does take a part, but to what extent, I have a hard time because I'm not hearing the opposing viewpoint. And when we're talking about the free and open exchange of ideas, I think that's why the majority of the people in the United States are becoming more and more skeptical because they keep hearing one side only.
Paul, your line's breaking up, but we've got the main point. You're saying skeptics aren't heard. You're also hesitant to see UN or global action on this, maybe telling the U.S. what to do. Michael Mann, what about the Paul asserting that, you know, we're not hearing the full debate? The global warming skeptics are not being heard. How does that strike your ear?
Well, that's not true. I mean, skepticism, as I said before, is an essential thing in science. All scientists should be skeptics. They should subject their theories, their hypotheses, their data to all possible interpretations. They should consider all of the potential shortcomings in an argument. They should subject their own ideas to as much scrutiny as possible on all sides of the issue. Now, that has to be distinguished from what I would call contrarianism, which is not, in fact, skepticism. It's often in the form of a denial of what the science shows without subjecting that denial to the kind of scrutiny, to the kind of skepticism that it deserves. Not all ideas are equal. Not all propositions are equally valid. 1 + 1 = 2. If there were a mathematician who felt that 1 + 1 = 3, it's very likely that he or she would not be able to publish that paper in the peer-reviewed mathematical literature. Some ideas are more compelling than others. They have a grounding in the evidence. They can be defended logically in terms of the arguments leading to the conclusions. And indeed, much of my work, ironically enough, or a solid part of my body of work, has actually been has been celebrated by skeptics in the past. The work that I've done showing that natural climate variability may be important than some had suggested, work that I had done suggesting that there might be some shortcomings in the theoretical models that we use to model the climate system that still need work. So I myself am a skeptic and proud of it. But skepticism is very different from contrarianism. And simply thinking that one has the right to publish in the peer-reviewed literature an idea without providing scientific grounding, without defending the conclusions for that idea, that poor work, poor scholarship does not belong in the scientific literature. That's what peer review is all about.
Let's get a call from Portland, Maine, and Nick. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi. I actually have a question that's related to what Dr. Mann was just talking about. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if they could comment on the role of the blogosphere in the public relations battle related to the physical science.
There are a lot of blogs out there in the skeptic community. Do you feel the hot breath of those blogs? Do they impact the scientific or the national conversation, Michael Mann?
Well, I'll tell you, some years ago, back in about 2004 or so, many of my scientific colleagues and I were horrified by the fact that if you Googled terms like climate change or global warming, all that came up were these various contrarian disinformation outlets, sites on the internet that are basically trying to confuse the public about the nature of the science. And so we did, in fact, fight back. In 2004, several colleagues of mine and I co-founded a website called Real Climate, realclimate.org. Mm. And it was our attempt to cut through that fog of disinformation and provide basic information about climate change, about stories, breaking stories in the popular discourse that are related to climate change, to provide a perspective from scientists who actually work in that field and are interested in trying to describe findings in a way that's accessible to a non-technical audience, policymakers, journalists, and we've been keeping this site going now ever since.
But clearly, as long as the internet is out there, anybody with any kind of opinion, and there's no peer review, can jump in and has a platform. That is a new dynamic in public discourse, I guess.
That's right, and that's forced us to go on the offensive. You know, our science has been distorted and misrepresented by those who appear to have an agenda, a policy agenda, to not see action taken on climate change. And I believe it is the role of the scientist to get out there and defend the science and make sure that the public does understand what the science actually has to say. That's why we do this blog. That's why I'm here talking to you, and many of my other colleagues are out talking about what the science actually shows.
Let's go to Jacob in Montgomery, Alabama. Our last call. Jacob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to address one thing. I've been listening really carefully just to the language being used
yes.
on the show today.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like there's a fair degree of spin and political language kind of creeping its way in there. I just wonder how you would address that.
Jacob, thanks for your call. Carol Doherty, let me come first to you. You do public polling all the time. The questions, the words you use to ask the questions are important. It's very hard at this point to separate global warming from political issues. It's a highly politicized subject. Can you ask a pure question? Can you get a pure answer, Carol?
Well, it's clear that different wording yields different results. The Washington Post poll asks if global warming is probably happening. More than 70% say yes. Our poll asks if there's solid evidence. Only 57% say yes. So the words used are very important, and you will get different results.
And what about your different findings globally? Is there a more politicized conversation in this country, the United States, is it your sense, Carol, than in other countries around the world?
You do see some of the same elements, the same conservative-liberal split, particularly in Great Britain, which is very interesting, even in Western Europe, not so much elsewhere.
Michael Mann, we've just got a minute here. What are your hopes for Copenhagen? Do you think something will come out of it that will propel the kind of action you're looking for as a climate scientist?
Well, I do. Many of us who study the climate believe that if we were to see as much as 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit warming relative to pre-industrial times, which is something at current rates of emissions we would easily achieve within the next century, we start to see some of the more damaging impacts of climate change. And to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations so that we don't see that amount of warming, we essentially have to bring them to a peak within the next decade. We need to bring them down to about 50% of their late 20th century levels by mid-century. And every year that we delay taking action, it becomes that much more difficult to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations at those levels. So it's essential that we start to make progress. We're not going to solve the whole problem here in Copenhagen, but we can certainly, policymakers can certainly establish a framework to ensure that we will work towards that goal.
Well, it is all on the table in Denmark, in Copenhagen this week, maybe more than the planners first envisioned, but certainly grabbing a lot of attention right around the world and some, we hope, serious discussion coming out as a result. We will follow it right throughout. We're grateful to our guests today. Michael Mann at Pennsylvania State University, thank you very much for being with us, Professor Mann.
Thank you, Tom.
And Carol Doherty with the Pew Center for People and the Press. Carol, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.